we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. As usual, a full plate of items, starting with local and some more changes at the Seattle Police Department.
Yeah, this week, Seattle Police Department Assistant Chief Mike Sanford announced his retirement. Excuse me. He said he's going to retire March 31st, but then he turned around and he said in the interim, before then, he's going to take an extended leave of absence for 2.5 months.
I've got some vacation days I want to use.
But for 2.5 months, that made me wonder, whoa, was he forced out or did he just see the writing on the wall? Now, last week we talked about how new mayor of Seattle came in and replaced interim Seattle Police Chief Jim Pugel with a new police chief, Harry Bailey, and that he was expecting that Harry Bailey would be making some new personnel decisions. And of course, everyone asked the question at that time, Mayor, are you going to be replacing the two remaining assistant chiefs? The other two were demoted by Pugel in December. And Mayor Ed Murray said, oh, no, the new chief will be making those decisions. Well, clearly, one of those decisions has already been made.
Yeah. And this, again, this is what Murray did in bringing in somebody who was not just a new interim chief, but somebody who was retired, didn't have a lot of connections with the current department. That's the sort of bringing in an outside force, somebody who's not going to stand for permanent chief, that McGinn should have done a year ago, the same way that McGinn should have brought in an outsider when he chose Diaz 4 years ago. And that the fact that those things didn't happen is exactly why those kind of problems have continued at SPD, because the institution runs so top to bottom with cultural problems that you really need to clean house like that. And it's really nice to see it happening now.
Yeah.
And that some of the old dinosaurs were perpetuating, not specifically passing judgment on Sanford, but that in general, some of the people who oversaw and in like all likelihood were perpetuating those problems are hearing the music.
Yeah. And, you know, Sanford oversaw the Professional Standards Bureau, which was supposed to implement a lot of the DOJ reforms. So the fact that he's retiring and leaving his post early before his actual retirement, I think, is a sign that Harry Bailey's in there and he's going to try to push those reforms forward.
And it also gives some context to the Merrick Bob, the federal oversight person's repeated reports that there was inside opposition to the reform process.
Within the management.
Yeah. Within the senior management. And,
yeah.
And now we might know where some of that was coming from.
All right. Moving on, some proposed solutions for transportation.
Yeah, this week the King County Executive Dow Constantine announced a countywide ballot measure for transportation funding. He's submitting this to the council, and the county council will decide whether or not to submit it to the ballot for voters to decide on April 22nd. Now, this countywide ballot measure is to fund transportation spending in just within King County. 60% of the funds from it are supposed to go to metro and other transit projects, and 40% will go to roads. Whether or not that means road maintenance or road construction, I don't know, because there aren't a whole lot of details yet. Now, Seattle is expected...
That hasn't been specified yet.
Yeah, Seattle is expected to get about $16.5 million from the roads portion of that package. Now, what the funding mechanism will be is that it will increase the vehicle license fees by $60 per year on everyone, regardless of the make or model of your vehicle. It's supposed to also increase the sales tax by 0.1%, which means in the city of Seattle, people would be paying 9.6% in sales tax.
Actually, a minor modification to that, mm-hmm. $20 of that $60 for the VLF fee comes after the current $20 congestion relief charge expires in June. So it's actually a net $40
increase. So it's
actually
a replacement, so about $40 increase total in vehicle license fees. And then also Metro Transit bus riders would have to pay an additional 25 cents. So another fare increase for transit riders
Which was planned already, by the way.
Yeah, coming after 4 years of fare increases in 2008, 9, 10, and 11. So, and in order to offset this for low-income riders, Constantine proposed a new reduced fare for low-income Metro Transit riders, but it's not clear to me how bus drivers would be able to actually enforce that, particularly since so many people pay with cash when they get on the bus still.
Yeah. Now, the idea behind this is that this is because the state legislature, specifically the Republicans that control the state Senate, have been blocking passage of a transportation bill. And that transportation bill has not only forestalled any kind of state spending on transportation overall, but it has also even prevented King County from having its own vote on any kind of a measure to fund the 17% shortfall that Metro is anticipating as of in a few months, which would lead to, as we've already learned, because Metro has already planned what those cuts would be, pretty draconian cuts at a time of record ridership. This is basically a screw you to Olympia, saying that if you can't do transportation funding, we're going to fund it separately, and the voters of King County are going to fund it separately, and we're not going to be held hostage by the state. So this can be seen either as we're going to have a vote on this very quickly within 3 months on April 22nd, or we're going to have a vote on this right after the end of the 60-day legislative session if Olympia does not get its act together. And so the Republicans in the state legislature are now between a rock and a hard place between, isn't this fun screwing liberal Seattle on the one hand, and, oh, my God, we're going to lose our leverage over screwing liberal Seattle on the other. So we'll see if it gets Olympia to move at all. But, given that even if they fund this the transportation bill this year, it could still be held hostage in future years. It still makes a lot of sense for the King County government to try and propose some sort of a permanent solution to this.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll make a prediction that I don't expect much out of the state legislature.
Oh, I expect a lot out of the state legislature, but not anything constructive.
Yeah, we might usefully ask what Governor Jay Inslee expects out of the state legislature. He gave a speech this last week called his State of the State speech, and I'm just going to cover the four main topics in his speech. Education was at the top of the list because of the McCleary ruling last week, where the state Supreme Court said that under their earlier McCleary ruling that said that the state legislature had to adequately fund, is required by the state constitution to adequately fund K-12 education, and that the state legislature has not been doing that.
And that they didn't meet that,
and that they
last
didn't,
year.
Yeah, that they didn't in the first year after the original McCleary ruling, that the state did not meet the requirements, and that they're not going fast enough in plugging that hole. The governor is addressing that, saying that, well, I'm going to propose $200 million more for K-12 education. Well, and I just want to point out that that's about one-tenth of what was needed last year, and is probably about one-fifth of what the legislature should at least come up with as a minimum to fund K-12 education this year.
A minimum additional.
Yeah, to what they put in the budget last year. Inslee also said that he wanted the legislature to add a cost of living increase for teachers, since they haven't had a raise in what has been about 4 or 5 years now. And he also wants to close, in order to fund that, he thinks that the state legislature should close some tax loopholes and repeal some tax exemptions to pay for it. That didn't happen last year when he pushed for it, and I don't think it's going to happen again this year. And then moving on, he talked about transportation. He called on the legislature, like everybody, pretty much everybody else in the state has, to pass a transportation funding package, as if the governor saying, please fund a transportation package, is going to make any difference with a Republican-controlled state Senate. He then went on to talk about the aerospace industry, basically spent a large part of his speech explaining why it was a good thing to pass nine for the legislature to be convened in a special session last year and pass $9 billion in tax giveaways to Boeing when they didn't weren't able to pass a $10 billion transportation funding package.
I was wondering why I was wearing knee pads during that speech.
Yeah, and you should remember too, this comes at a time when state legislators down in Olympia are sending letters to Boeing management saying, hey, that $9 billion in tax giveaways was nice, but we're ready to do more for you, including gut water quality regulations, and we're willing to make changes to the workers' compensation system for you. Just tell us what you need. We're here to serve you. Unlike what they're telling the rest of us when they say, we're not going to fund transportation.
Education.
Yeah, or education.
Or roads.
Yeah. Right. Or do any of the things that government is supposed to do for the people who elected them to office.
And pay their bills.
Exactly. And so he talked about one more big thing in his speech, which was income inequality. He was kind of forced to talk about this because of the campaign of Shama Sawant running on the $15 an hour minimum wage and winning city council, her city council position. He's kind of forced now to talk about income inequality because typically minimum wage in a state comes from the state government, not typically from the local government. So he said, I'm going to ask the state legislature to increase the statewide minimum wage. And then he said, well, I don't really have a good idea of what that should be. Then he went on to say, but I'd prefer them to pass a minimum wage of about $11 to $12 an hour, which is not sufficient. Really. And then he went on to say, just to give businesses a little bit of something, I want to exempt super small businesses who have less than $50,000 a year in revenues from paying B&O taxes.
Yeah.
Which is a pretty easy thing to do, I think.
Yeah. And I also, you know, in terms of that and the minimum wage, I want to accept super small businesses like Boeing, for example.
who don't have to pay taxes now.
Actually, they get paid back by the government.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, they got one sweet tax loophole there.
So that's mm-hmm. the state of the state address by our governor.
Yeah. All right.
All of which will probably fall on deaf ears in the state Senate. Except for the stuff about Boeing.
Moving on, the Washington WashDOT.
Yes, WashDOT. This week, the Washington State Department of Transportation Secretary sent a letter to the Seattle Tunnel contractors. Those are the guys who are digging the big tunnel under the city of Seattle to replace the Alaskan Way Viaduct, the elevated freeway with a tunnel freeway. Bertha, the drilling machine, the biggest such drilling machine ever constructed, which is supposed to be drilling the hole for the tunnel, has been stuck in the ground for 6 weeks now. And the State Department of Transportation is looking at doing something about it finally. They sent a letter to the tunnel contractors. And what was interesting in looking at that letter to me is that the Department of Transportation is taking the tunnel contractors to task for how they've been operating the drill, saying that the contractors may have been running Bertha at speeds that generate too much heat and wear on the cutting surfaces of the drill. Now,
in other words, it has nothing to do with pipes at all?
Yeah, and I knew that the whole pipe theory, the fact that Bertha may have hit a pipe and that's what stopped the drill, I knew that that was bogus because Bertha hit the pipe and then went on to operate perfectly well for 3 days after that, including turning in a day in which it drilled 58 feet, which was a record.
So the whole thing was a pipe dream, is what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly. That the pipe thing was an excuse. And it seems to me that what WashDOT is saying now is that they think the tunnel contractors were not operating the drill properly. Now, that may not be the total story. There may be some other issues there because, like I say, Bertha is a one of a kind. There's never been a drill made that's that big. It's the first time a drill that size has been made. And there could be some design flaws. We've certainly seen that before in machines like this that are one of a kind machines. But WashDOT is clearly positioning itself to bring a lawsuit against somebody for some problems with the drill itself, whether that's the manufacturer or whether that's the contractors who are operating the drill,
or both.
We'll have to see. But it really brings to mind this question: what do we do if Bertha's broken and can't be fixed and can't be restarted? It can't be reversed. They're going to have to go down in some really hostile conditions and take it apart and pull it out and have to manufacture another one just like it, or hopefully better designed, to take its place. That's going to mean enormous delays. And it also brings up the scenario of maybe those of us who were critics of the tunnel in the first place may get our surface boulevard replacement after all.
nonsense. Nothing else can possibly go wrong, and I'm really looking forward to the new Seattle-Shanghai Expressway.
Yeah.
Well, my understanding is also that the Washington State doesn't officially pay for BERTHA until it reaches
a certain
500 feet or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, but mm-hmm. you know, there are always costs to delays like this.
Sure. Oh, yeah. No, it's costing us every day.
So, yeah, it's costing us every hour that it sits idle.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. All right. Bob Ferguson.
Yeah, the state attorney general ruled this week that localities can ban marijuana shops under the I-502 because the sponsors of the initiative didn't make any specification in the initiative that state law overrode the abilities of localities to regulate or ban the shops. And so as with any other type of business, whether it's, you know, strip clubs or liquor stores or whatever it might be, localities do in fact have the ability to regulate and or ban them. The upshot of this is kind of concerning because obviously we're going to wind up with a number of localities around the state who have wanted to do and will now go ahead and do exactly that. So we'll have, you know, the weed equivalent of wet counties and dry counties.
Yeah. Currently, Pierce County doesn't allow. They voted to ban.
Yeah, and they've had a county council that's been very hostile toward both medical and recreational marijuana for many years, and that raises the question of where this leaves medical marijuana patients, because the state, in the initial regulations that it's promulgated around this, has really been trying to force the MMJ patients onto the commercial market. Well, what happens when you take a medication, put it on the commercial market, and then it's not available in big chunks of the state? That's going to be really problematic. There is the ACLU of Washington, which was one of the primary sponsors of the initiative, has said on a city-by-city basis they will fight attempts to ban it. And, of course, there's also, at this point, marijuana trade groups that are trying to do the same thing. But, you know, that's been the case all along so far with fairly limited success. And there is also a bill now introduced in the House that would override the banned by localities, but getting that once again through the state Senate seems unlikely. So this is gonna pose a big problem for implementation of 502.
All right. On to national and President Obama's surveillance speech.
Yeah, this week President Obama gave his national surveillance speech. Really, this was to address all the revelations that have come since Edward Snowden leaked the massive trove of documents that he smuggled out of his national security job.
Yeah, this is called damage control.
It really is. And it's interesting because he spends a good portion of the first part of his speech assuring us that no abuses have occurred, which is really not telling the truth. We know from the documents that Snowden leaked that abuses have occurred. We even know from some of the documents that have been declassified by the federal government that came through the FISA court that, yes, there have been abuses.
And abuses of a process that is itself inherently abusive as
yeah.
well.
Yeah. And so you have to ask, why then the necessity for this speech? Well, as Jobs says, it's damage control. And of course, we know that it is because President Obama is announcing some changes, but the changes are pretty vague and there's not a whole lot of substance to them.
Cosmetic, I think, is the term.
Exactly. Yeah. He admits that 6 months ago he created a review group to recommend, quote unquote, reforms. He dismisses bulk collection of data as analogous to corporations collecting data online to target you for advertising, which is not at all the same thing. His reforms include a new presidential directive, which basically is tasking his executive aides, to occasionally review intelligence activities, which makes me wonder what they haven't been doing it so far. You know, you've undergone this massive expansion of intelligence gathering capabilities, and you're not really overseeing it.
Yeah, bear in mind that Obama is talking about reforming a process that he himself has created. So,
was created under the Bush administration, but that he himself is continuing.
Well, vastly expanded, put it that way.
And has expanded, yes. And he's also said, as part of this presidential directive, that he will declassify more FISA court opinions. Well, yeah, okay.
But didn't give a timeline. timeline on that. It could be any time between now and, say, 2314.
Yeah, and didn't tell us what the criteria would be. He's also asking Congress to establish an outside panel to participate somehow in the FISA court. He was not specific about what that participation would be or what the panel will do. I guess Congress will determine that. Nor did he say that he would make the court public, which is what critics, including people like me, are asking him to do. He also is adding certain unspecified restrictions on the government's ability to use the communications between American citizens and foreign citizens. Again, he didn't specify what those restrictions were. He said that he would eventually declassify most national security letters. Those are the letters sent out to people like to companies like AT&T, for example, asking for data.
And that those themselves, they're gag orders as well because they can't,
because they say
can't be discussed.
That, yeah, they say that AT&T and other vendors cannot tell anyone that they've received a national security letter or what that letter contains. He said that he will declassify and make those public eventually. Didn't say when, didn't say that he would make them all available either. He just said most. He said that he was going to put in place a transition to end the bulk collection of data by the government first he wants the intelligence community to study how that would how that would happen and who would have control of the bulk data. So he didn't say that it would actually occur, just that he was going to take steps towards it.
Yeah, and that he wasn't saying that the practice would stop. He said basically what he said was, well, we don't want the government to do it any longer. We want private contractors to do it, or say telecommunications companies, which I suppose is supposed to make us feel better. And then there were several other things too. But you know, the most interesting part is what he didn't talk about. He really didn't talk about anything that didn't have to do directly with the phone monitoring program. So that, for example, he actually did. He promised not to spy on dozens of heads of foreign government. Presumably there'll be scores instead, unless of course it's in America's interest. In that case, all bets are off. He didn't cover encryption or backdoors into your own personal machines, didn't cover internet or email monitoring, didn't cover collection of financial records, geolocation data, scores and scores of different types of surveillance that were not even addressed remotely by these reforms, quote-unquote reforms. Very, very much, what's the phrase, putting lipstick on a pig?
Yeah.
Meanwhile,
there were some new revelations this week from the Snowden documents in the New York Times and The Guardian. The NSA apparently has implanted equipment in over 100,000 computers worldwide that allow the NSA to access data without using the Internet. So computers that have been isolated from the Internet can still be accessed by the NSA through old-fashioned radio waves. This is called the Quantum Program. It's been used against the Russian military, against the Chinese army and Mexican drug cartels, but it's also been used against some of our allies like the Mexican police, trade institutions inside the European Union, and our allies in the war on terror like Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, and India. It involves using devices that, in one case, one such device looks like a normal USB drive, but it has a tiny, tiny radio transmitter in it, which allows the NSA to get access to that computer by activating that radio transmitter and pulling data through radio waves. Now, also this week, The Guardian revealed the Dishfire program, which is where the NSA has been gathers almost 200 million text messages a day. So this puts a lie to President Obama's assertion in his speech that the NSA is not reading the content of your emails, not listening to your phone calls. They're definitely reading the content of your text messages.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on, the budget bill came out.
Yeah, and this week the Congress passed a $1.1 trillion budget bill in which the Republicans gained almost none of their big initiatives that they wanted to see in the budget. Most of their big cuts did not make it into this $1.1 trillion budget bill, which leads me and a whole bunch of other people to ask, well, what was the shutdown, the whole government shutdown about in the first place?
No answer for
that. No answer for that.
A tantrum, maybe?
It was, yeah, apparently a temper tantrum that was meant to destroy the Republican Party, because that's clearly what's happening.
All right.
I think it was meant to destroy the Republic, but it is instead destroying the Republican
report,
Party.
Yes. Report coming out of the Department of Veteran Affairs.
Yeah, at least 22 veterans commit suicide each day, according to the Department of Veteran Affairs report. Male veterans under the age of 30 are three times as likely to do so as their civilian counterparts. And the number of suicides of 18 to 24-year-olds in particular has gone up over the period of 2009-2012. All that according to this new report. And it continues a trend that's been going on a number of years of increased suicide among young vets, especially combat vets. The most interesting part of this, I mean, aside from the overall arc of it, was that the suicides among those enrolled in the Veteran Health Administration program are down about 30%, but suicides among vets who aren't hooked up to VA programs are up 60%. So the suicide prevention and mental health and PTSD treatment and other those types of programs that the VA is offering are, in fact, having a huge impact. Remember that the next time you see conservatives trying to either defund veteran services or saying that a government-run healthcare program just can't work.
All right. And two court rulings?
Yeah. Judge Paul Freeman of the conservative U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia struck down the last of the major foundational challenges to the Affordable Care Act this week. That was a selective reading of the law that claimed that Congress didn't authorize tax credits for people buying insurance on the federal health care exchange, only on the 16 state-established exchanges, which is kind of ridiculous since the federal exchange was specifically set up, you know, to offer services to people who lived in states that where the local states wouldn't do it, which is to say all the Republican controlled states plus a few very small states. So there's one left that is that would overturn all of Obamacare. That's a bizarre one that claims that the ACA is unconstitutional because most of it originated in the Senate. Yeah, they're that desperate. The remaining challenges, though, are all over specific pieces of the ACA, for example, abortion provision. Everything is at this point is about wrangling over provisions or budgets to budgets for actually implementing it. The ACA itself is here to stay.
All right.
Also, we had a ruling in Pennsylvania this week, a Pennsylvania judge ruling that that state's voter ID law, and you may remember a state legislature for that, got a lot of internet fame in 2012 by bragging that that law would deliver Pennsylvania to Romney in 2012. It did not do that, that law was unconstitutional. That even after the state admitted in the course of discovery proceedings for the lawsuit that it could point to no existing cases of voter fraud in the state of Pennsylvania, let alone ones that the restrictions would have prevented, even though that was the stated rationale for that and most of these other Republican state voter ID laws.
So it became clear that really it had been passed as a form of discrimination.
Yes, that has basically had a disproportionate impact on non-white voters, on elderly voters, on college students. In other words, people who are likely to vote Democratic or likelier. Pennsylvania, though, the state is likely to appeal the ruling to the U.S. Supreme Court. Pity they're quite not so rigorous in their logic. Can't be that rationale. Maybe it's this other one.
All right. And events.
Yeah. Several of them coming up this week. Tomorrow at noon and then again also Monday at 2 p.m., the Real Change Economic Justice Film Series doing screenings of As Goes Janesville. That'll be at the Northwest Film Forum at 1515 12th Avenue, just north of Pike Pine on Capitol Hill. Also on Sunday, tomorrow, from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m., Trans-Pacific Partnership, a supersized version of NAFTA, a presentation on our latest and worst free trade agreement that's being rammed through Congress. That'll be at the Woodland Park Presbyterian Church, sponsored by the Fellowship of Reconciliation, at 225 North 70th Street in at Greenwood in Finney Ridge. On Monday, MLK Day, and of course we'll be having our annual MLK Day celebration at Garfield High School. Workshops at 9:30, rally at 11, and march at 12:30 at Garfield at 23rd and Jefferson in the CD. Also on Monday in the evening from 7:30 to 8:30, Ian Haney Lopez will be at Town Hall talking about destroying the middle class one word at a time. That's right-wing dog whistles and memes like Welfare Queen and Takers and how that influences the political discourse and has economic implications. That should be pretty interesting. $5 at Town Hall, 8th and Seneca.
And then on Thursday, January 23rd, 7 o'clock, Fukushima Despair and Action at the Common Good Cafe, University Temple United Methodist Church, 43rd and 15th Northeast in the U District. So plenty going on this week.
Anyway, talking with John Parrish and Maria Tomchik with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
I don't know.
Eat the
I'm
State.
Confused.
Eat the State can be found online at www.eatthestate.org.